Hello, and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. The first feature article is Mortality Risk in Pediatric Sepsis Based on C-reactive protein and ferritin levels by Christopher Horvat et al. Objectives: interest in using bedside C-reactive protein, or CRP, and ferritin levels to identify patients with hyperinflammatory sepsis who might benefit from anti-inflammatory therapies has peaked with the COVID-19 pandemic experience. Our first objective was to identify patterns in CRP and ferritin trajectory among critically ill pediatric sepsis patients. We then examined the association between these different groups of patients in their inflammatory cytokine responses, systemic inflammation, and mortality risks. Data sources: a prospective observational cohort study. Study selection: children with sepsis and organ failure in 9 pediatric intensive care units in the United States. Data extraction: 255 children were enrolled. 5 distinct clinical multi-trajectory groups were identified. Plasma CRP, ferritin, and 31 cytokine levels were measured at 2 time points during sepsis, median day 2 and day 5. Group-based multi-trajectory models identified groups of children with distinct patterns of CRP and ferritin. Data synthesis: Group 1 had normal CRP and ferritin levels, with an N equal to 8 and 0% mortality. Group 2 had high CRP levels that became normal, with normal ferritin levels throughout, with an N of 80 and 5% mortality. Group 3 had high ferritin levels alone, with an N of 16 and 6% mortality. Group 4 had very high CRP levels and high ferritin levels with an N of 121 and 11% mortality. And group 5 had very high CRP and very high ferritin levels with an N of 30 and 40% mortality. Cytokine responses differed across the 5 groups, with ferritin levels correlated with macrophage inflammatory protein 1 alpha levels and CRP levels reflective of many cytokines. Conclusions: Bedside CRP and ferritin levels can be used together to distinguish groups of children with sepsis who have different systemic inflammation cytokine responses and mortality risks. These data suggest future potential value in personalized clinical trials with specific targets for anti-inflammatory therapies. The second feature article is Mid-Regional Pro-Adrenomedulin in Combination with Pediatric Early Warning Scores for Risk Stratification of Febrile Children Presenting to the Emergency Department. Secondary analysis of a non-pre-specified United Kingdom cohort study by Rebecca Lenahan et al. Objectives: current sepsis guidelines do not provide good risk stratification of subgroups in whom prompt IV antibiotics and fluid resuscitation might be of benefit. We evaluated the utility of mid-regional pro-adrenomedulin, or MR-pro-ADM, in identification of patient subgroups at risk of requiring PICU or high-dependency unit admission or fluid resuscitation. Design: secondary non-pre-specified analysis of a prospectively collected dataset. Setting: pediatric emergency department in a United Kingdom tertiary center. Patients: children less than 16 years old presenting with fever and clinical indication for venous blood sampling with an N equal to 1,183. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Primary outcome measures were PICU or high dependency unit admission or administration of fluid resuscitation with a secondary outcome of definite or probable bacterial infection. Biomarkers were measured on stored plasma samples and children phenotyped into bacterial and viral groups using a previously published algorithm. Of the 1,183 cases, 146 children, or 12.3%, required fluids, 48, or 4.1%, were admitted to the PICU or high dependency unit, and 244, or 20.6%, had definite or probable bacterial infection. Area under the receiver operating characteristic, or AUC, curve was used to assess performance. MR-PRO-ADM better predicted fluid resuscitation than both procalcitonin and pediatric early warning scores. The AUC for MR-PRO-ADM was 0.73 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.67 to 0.78. The AUC for procalcitonin was 0.65 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.59 to 0.71. And the AUC for the pediatric early warning score was 0.62 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.56 to 0.67. The pediatric early warning score alone showed good accuracy for PICU or high dependency unit admission, with an AUC of 0.83 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.78 to 0.89. Patient subgroups with high MR pro ADM greater than or equal to 0.7 nanomoles per liter and high procalcitonin greater than or equal to 0.5 nanograms per milliliter had increased association with PICU or high dependency unit admission, fluid resuscitation, and bacterial infection compared with subgroups with low MR pro ADM less than 0.7 nanomoles per liter. For children with procalcitonin less than 0.5 nanograms per milliliter, high MR-PRO-ADM improved stratification for fluid resuscitation only. In conclusion, high MR-PRO-ADM and high procalcitonin were associated with increased likelihood of subsequent disease progression. Incorporating MR-PRO-ADM into clinical risk stratification may be useful in clinical decision-making regarding initiation of IV antibiotics, fluid resuscitation, and escalation to PICU or high-dependency unit admission. The third feature article is Fluid Accumulation in Mechanically Ventilated Critically Ill Children, Retrospective Cohort Study of Prevalence and Outcome by Ben Gelbart et al. Objectives: to describe the prevalence, patterns, explanatory variables, and outcomes associated with fluid accumulation in mechanically ventilated children. The design was a retrospective cohort study. The setting was a tertiary PICU. Patients included children mechanically ventilated for greater than or equal to 24 hours. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Between July 2016 and July 2021, 1,636 children met eligibility criteria. Median age was 5.5 months with an interquartile range of 0.7 to 46.5 months, and congenital heart disease was the most common diagnosis. Overall, by day 7 of admission, the median maximum cumulative fluid accumulation as a percentage of estimated admission weight was 7.5% with an interquartile range of 3.3 to 15.1 occurring at a median of 4 days after admission. Overall, higher fluid accumulation was associated with greater duration of mechanical ventilation, longer intensive care length of stay, longer hospital length of stay, and increased mortality. Mechanical ventilation duration mean difference was 1.17 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.13 to 1.22 and a p-value less than 0.001. Intensive care length of stay mean difference was 1.16 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.12 to 1.21 and a p-value less than 0.001. Hospital length of stay mean difference was 1.19 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.13 to 1.26 and a p-value less than 0.001, and mortality odds ratio was 1.13 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.08 to 1.59 and a p-value equal to 0.005. However, these associations depended on the effects of children with extreme values, and there was no increase in risk up to 20% fluid accumulation overall in children following cardiopulmonary bypass and in children in the general ICU. When excluding children with maximum fluid accumulation of greater than 10%, there was no association with duration of mechanical ventilation and intensive care or hospital length of stay, but there was an association with reduced mortality. Mechanical ventilation duration mean difference was 0.99 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.94 to 1.04 and a p-value equal to 0.64. Intensive care length of stay mean difference was 1.01 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.96 to 1.06 and a p-value equal to 0.7. And hospital length of stay mean difference was 1.01 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.95 to 1.08 and a p-value equal to 0.79. The reduced mortality had a mean difference of 0.71 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.53 to 0.97 and a p-value equal to 0.03. Conclusions: in mechanically ventilated critically ill children, greater maximum fluid accumulation was associated with longer duration of mechanical ventilation, intensive care length of stay, hospital length of stay, and mortality. However, these findings were driven by extreme values of fluid accumulation of greater than 20%, and up to 10% there was reduced mortality and no signal of harm. The feature review article is Clinical Challenges in Pediatric Ventilation Liberation, a Meta-Narrative Review by Jephta Van Dyke et al. Objectives: to map the evidence for ventilation liberation practices in pediatric respiratory failure using the realist and meta-narrative evidence synthesis evolving standards publication standards. Data sources: CINAHL, Medline, Cochrane, and Embase. Trial registers included the following: clinicaltrials.gov, European Union Clinical Trials Register, and International Standardized Randomized Control Trial Number Register. Study selection: abstracts were screened followed by review of full text. Articles published in English language incorporating a heterogeneous population of both infants and older children were assessed. There was no data extraction. Data synthesis: weaning can be considered as the process by which positive pressure is decreased and the patient becomes increasingly responsible for generating the energy necessary for effective gas exchange. With the growing use of non-invasive respiratory support, extubation can lie in the middle of the weaning process if some additional positive pressure is used after extubation, while for some, extubation may constitute the end of weaning. Testing for extubation readiness is a key component of the weaning process as it allows the critical care practitioner to assess the capability and endurance of the patient's respiratory system to resume unassisted ventilation. Spontaneous breathing trials are often seen as extubation readiness testing, but the spontaneous breathing trial is used to determine if the patient can maintain adequate spontaneous ventilation with minimal ventilatory support, whereas extubation readiness testing implies the patient is ready for extubation. Conclusions: current literature suggests using a structured approach that includes a daily assessment of patients' readiness to extubate may reduce total ventilation time. Increasing evidence indicates that such daily assessments needs to include spontaneous breathing trials without added pressure support. Measures of elevated load as well as measures of impaired respiratory muscle capacity are independently associated with extubation failure in children, indicating that these should also be assessed as part of extubation readiness testing. The first clinical investigation article is Prolonged Mechanical Ventilation in Pediatric Trauma Patients in a Combat Zone by Andrew Moulton et al. Objectives: it is well known that polytrauma can lead to acute lung injury. Respiratory failure has been previously observed in combat trauma, but not reported in children, who account for over 11% of bed days at deployed military treatment facilities using significant resources. We seek to identify risk factors associated with prolonged mechanical ventilation, which is important in resource planning and allocation in austere environments. Design: retrospective review of prospectively collected data within the United States Department of Defense Trauma Registry. Setting: deployed U.S. military treatment facilities in Iraq and Afghanistan from 2007 to 2016. Patients: all pediatric subjects who required at least one day of mechanical ventilation, excluding patients who died on day zero. Interventions: prolonged mechanical ventilation was defined using the Yowden Index for Mortality. A multivariable logistic regression model was then performed to identify factors associated with prolonged mechanical ventilation. Measurements and main results: the Yowden Index identified greater than or equal to 6 days as the cutoff for prolonged mechanical ventilation. Of the 859 casualties included in the analysis, 154, or 17.9%, had prolonged mechanical ventilation. On univariable analysis, age, severe injury to the thorax and skin, 24-hour volume per kilogram administration of crystalloids, colloids, platelets, plasma, and packed red blood cells was associated with prolonged mechanical ventilation. In the multivariable model, crystalloids, colloids, platelets, severe injury to the thorax, and severe injury to the skin were associated with prolonged mechanical ventilation. Crystalloids had an odds ratio of 1.04 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.02 to 1.07. Colloids had an odds ratio of 1.24 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.04 to 1.49. Platelets had an odds ratio of 1.03 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.01 to 1.05. Severe injury to the thorax had an odds ratio of 2.24 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.41 to 3.48, and severe injury to the skin had an odds ratio of 4.48 with a 95% confidence interval of 2.72 to 7.38. Model goodness of fit R squared was 0.14. Conclusions: In this analysis of factors associated with prolonged mechanical ventilation in pediatric trauma patients in a combat zone, in addition to severe injury to skin and thorax, we found that administration of crystalloids, colloids, and platelets were independently associated with greater odds of prolonged mechanical ventilation. Our findings will help inform resource planning and suggest potential resuscitation strategies for future studies. The second clinical investigation article is Derivation and Validation of Vasoactive Inotrope Score Trajectory Groups in Critically Ill Children with Shock by Lipsa Perizes et al. Objectives: to determine whether there are clinically relevant and reproducible vasoactive inotrope score trajectories in children with shock during the acute phase of critical illness. Design: retrospective observational cohort study. Setting: 2 tertiary academic PICUs. Patients: children less than 18 years old who required vasoactive infusions within 24 hours of admission to the PICU. Those admitted post-cardiac surgery were excluded. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. An hourly vasoactive inotropic score was calculated for the first 72 hours after initiation of vasoactives. Group-based trajectory modeling was applied to a derivation set with 75% of encounters and compared with the trajectories in a validation set with 25% of encounters using the same variables. The primary outcome was in-hospital mortality, and the secondary outcome was multiple organ dysfunction syndrome, or MODS, on day 7. A total of 1,828 patients met inclusion criteria, and 309, or 16.9%, died. Group-based trajectory modeling identified 4 subgroups that were reproducible in the validation set. The mild, fast-resolving shock group had an N of 853, or 47%, and a mortality rate of 9%. The moderate, slow-resolving shock group had an N of 422, or 23%, with a mortality rate of 15%. The moderate prolonged shock group had an N of 312 for 17% and a mortality rate of 21%, and the severe prolonged shock group had an N of 241 or 13% and mortality rate of 40%. There was a significant difference in mortality, MODS on day 7, and suspected infection across groups with a p-value less than 0.001. The mild, fast-resolving shock and severe prolonged shock groups were identifiable within the first 24 hours. The moderate slow-resolving and moderate prolonged shock groups were indistinguishable in the first 24 hours after initiation of vasoactives, but differed in-hospital mortality and MODS on day 7. Hydrocortisone administration was independently associated with poor outcomes in the mild, fast-resolving shock group. Conclusions: we uncovered 4 distinct and reproducible vasoactive inotropic score trajectory groups that were associated with different risk factors, response to therapy, and outcomes in children with shock. Characterizing vasoactive inotropic score trajectory groups in the acute phase of critical illness may enable better prognostication and more targeted management. The first neurocritical intensive care article is Validation of a Computational Phenotype to Identify Acute Brain Dysfunction in Pediatric Sepsis by Alicia Alcamo et al. Objectives: to validate a computational phenotype that identifies acute brain dysfunction based on clinician concern for neurologic or behavioral changes in pediatric sepsis. Design: retrospective observational study. Setting: single academic children's hospital. Patients: 4,289 index sepsis episodes. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. An existing computational phenotype of acute brain dysfunction was optimized to include routinely collected variables indicative of clinician concern for acute neurologic or behavioral change, including completion of CT or MRI, electroencephalogram, or new antipsychotic administration. First, the computational phenotype was compared with an acute brain dysfunction reference standard established from chart review of 527 random sepsis episodes to determine criterion validity. Next, the computational phenotype was compared with a separate validation cohort of 3,762 index sepsis episodes to determine content and construct validity. Criterion validity for the final phenotype had sensitivity of 83% with a 95% confidence interval of 76 to 89%, specificity of 93% with a 95% confidence interval of 90 to 95%, positive predictive value of 84% with a 95% confidence interval of 77 to 89%, and negative predictive value of 93% with a 95% confidence interval of 90 to 96%. In the validation cohort, the computational phenotype identified acute brain dysfunction in 35% with a 95% confidence interval of 33 to 36%. Content validity was demonstrated as those with the acute brain dysfunction computational phenotype were more likely to have characteristics of neurologic dysfunction and severe illness than those without the acute brain dysfunction phenotype, including non-reactive pupils, 15% versus 1% with a p-value less than 0.001, Glasgow Coma Scale less than 5, 44% versus 12% with a p-value less than 0.001, greater than or equal to 2 non-neurologic organ dysfunctions, 50% versus 25% with a p-value less than 0.001, and need for intensive care, 81% versus 65% with a p-value less than 0.001. Construct validity was demonstrated by higher odds for mortality, with an odds ratio of 6.9 and a 95% confidence interval of 5.3 to 9.1, and discharge to rehabilitation, with an odds ratio of 11.4 and a 95% confidence interval of 7.4 to 17.5 in patients with versus without the acute brain dysfunction computational phenotype. Conclusions. A computational phenotype of acute brain dysfunction indicative of clinical concern for new neurologic or behavioral change offers a valid retrospective measure to identify episodes of sepsis that involved acute brain dysfunction. This computational phenotype provides a feasible and efficient way to study risk factors for and outcomes from acute brain dysfunction using routinely collected clinical data. The second neurocritical intensive care article is Implementation of a Pediatric Neurocritical Care Program for Children with Status Epilepticus, Adherence to Continuous Electroencephalogram Monitoring by Isabella Herman et al. Objectives: to describe adherence to continuous electroencephalogram or CEEG monitoring as part of a pediatric neurocritical care or PNCC program for status epilepticus. Design: retrospective review of pre- and post-intervention cohorts. Setting: a pediatric referral hospital. Patients: children admitted to the PICU for status epilepticus. Interventions: we restructured the care delivery model to include a pediatric neurointensive care unit or neuro-ICU and expanded the CEEG capacity. We created a criteria-based CEEG pathway. We provided education to all providers, including the nursing staff. Measurements and main results. The main outcomes were: 1. The percentages of children meeting American Clinical Neurophysiology Society criteria who underwent CEEG monitoring, and 2. The time interval between PICU arrival and CEEG initiation. PICU admissions with the diagnosis of status epilepticus from May 2017 to December 2017 served as the baseline, which was compared with the same periods in 2018 to 2020 or the PNCC era. There were 60 admissions in the pre-PNCC period in 2017, 111 in 2018, 118 in 2019, and 108 in 2020. The percentages of admissions from each period that met ACNS criteria for CEEG monitoring were between 84% and 97%. In the pre-PNCC era, 22 of 52 or 42% admissions meeting ACNS criteria underwent CEEG monitoring. In the PNCC era, greater than or equal to 80% of the qualified admissions underwent CEEG monitoring, 74 of 93 or 80% in 2018, 94 of 115 or 82% in 2019, and 87 of 101 or 86% in 2020. Compared with the pre-PNCC era, the neuro ICU had a shorter interval between PICU arrival and CEEG initiation, 216 minutes with an interquartile range of 141 to 1,444 minutes versus 138 minutes with an interquartile range of 103 to 211 minutes. Conclusions. The implementation of a PNCC program with initiatives in care delivery, allocation of resources, and education was associated with increased adherence to best care practices for the management of status epilepticus. The first online clinical investigation article is Hemostasis Proteins in Invasive Meningococcal and Non-Meningococcal Infections, a Prospective Multicenter Study, by Ninka Hagedorn et al. Objectives. We aimed to describe the variation of hemostasis proteins in children with bacterial infections due to different pathogens, including Neisseria meningitidis, Streptococcus pneumoniae, Staphylococcus aureus, and Group A Streptococcus, and to study hemostasis proteins in relation to mortality. Design: pre-planned analysis and prospective cohort study. Setting: hospitals in 5 European countries, including Austria, the Netherlands, Spain, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. Patients: admitted children from 2012 to 2016 with community-acquired infections due to meningococci with an N equal to 83, pneumococci with an N equal to 64, Staphylococcus aureus with an N equal to 50, and group A streptococcus with an N equal to 44, with available serum samples collected less than 48 hours after admission. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Fibronectin, plasminogen activator inhibitor type 1 or PAI1, thrombomodulin, and a disintegrin and metalloproteinase with a thrombospondin type 1 motif member 13 or ADAM TS13 were measured in serum in 2019 to 2020. Additionally, von Willebrand factor, protein C, protein S, and factor 9 were measured in citrate plasma available from a subset of patients. Outcome measures included in-hospital mortality and disease severity defined as the need for ventilation and or inotropes and pediatric index of mortality score. Of 241 children, 21 or 8.7% died and 177 or 73.5% were admitted to the PICU. Mortality rate was similar for the pathogen groups. Levels of fibronectin and thrombomodulin differed for the different pathogens, with a p-value less than 0.05. Fibronectin levels were lower in group A strep infections than in strep pneumoniae and staph aureus infections, but did not differ from meningococcal infections. Thrombomodulin levels in meningococcal infections were higher than in staph aureus and pneumococcal infections. Overall, the area under the curve for mortality was 0.81 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.7 to 0.92 for thrombomodulin and 0.78 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.69 to 0.88 for ADAM TS13. The association of each hemostasis protein did not vary across pathogens for any of the outcome measures. Conclusions. Hemostatic disturbances in childhood bacterial infections are not limited to meningococcal sepsis, but occur with a comparable severity across non-meningococcal infections. High thrombomodulin and high ADAM TS13 had good discriminative ability for mortality. Our results emphasize the importance of hemostatic disturbances in meningococcal and non-meningococcal pediatric bacterial infections. The second online clinical investigation is novel identification of myeloid-derived suppressor cells in children with septic shock by Catherine Blind et al. Objectives. Immunoparalysis in children with septic shock is associated with increased risk of nosocomial infections and death. Myeloid-derived suppressor cells, or MDSCs, potently suppress T-cell function and may perpetuate immunoparalysis. Our goal was to test the hypothesis that children with septic shock would demonstrate increased proportions of MDSCs and impaired immune function compared with healthy controls. Design, prospective observational study. Setting, 54-bed PICU in a quaternary care children's hospital. Patients, 18 children with septic shock and 30 age-matched healthy children. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Peripheral blood mononuclear cells were isolated from whole blood and stained for cell surface markers to identify MDSCs by flow cytometric analysis, including granulocytic and monocytic subsets. Adaptive and innate immune function was measured by ex vivo stimulation of whole blood with phytohemagglutinin-induced interferon or IFN-gamma production and lipopolysaccharide or LPS-induced tumor necrosis factor or TNF-alpha production, respectively. Prolonged organ dysfunction was defined as greater than 7 days. Children with septic shock had a higher percentage of circulating MDSCs, along with lower LPS-induced TNF-alpha and phytohemagglutinin-induced interferon-gamma production capacities compared with healthy controls. A cutoff of 25.2% MDSCs of total peripheral blood mononuclear cells in initial samples was optimal to discriminate children with septic shock who went on to have prolonged organ dysfunction, with an area under the curve equal to 0.86. Children with prolonged organ dysfunction also had decreased TNF-alpha production capacity over time compared with those who recovered more quickly, with a p-value equal to 0.02. Conclusions. This article is the first to describe increased MDSCs in children with septic shock along with an association between early increase in MDSCs and adverse organ dysfunction outcomes in this population. It remains unclear if MDSCs play a causative role in sepsis-induced immune suppression in children. Additional studies are warranted to establish MDSC as a potential therapeutic target. The third online clinical investigation article is entitled Decreases in Nephrotoxic Pain Medications Are Not Associated with Increased Opioid Utilization in Critically Ill Children by Aaron Stenson et al. Objectives. Quality improvement initiatives to decrease rates of nephrotoxic medication exposure have reduced rates of acute kidney injury or AKI in non-critically ill children. The objective of our study was to analyze the implementation of a similar program in critically ill children and to measure important balancing measures, including opioid and benzodiazepine exposure. Design: prospective quality improvement study. Setting: PICU at Children's Hospital Colorado between 2018 and 2020. Patients: all children admitted to the PICU. Interventions: quality improvement initiative called Nephrotoxic Injury Negated by Just-in-Time Action, or NINJA. Measurements and main results: 8,833 PICU patient admissions were included. Mean rates of nephrotoxic medication exposure per 1,000 PICU patient days decreased from 46 to 26, whereas rates of nephrotoxic acute kidney injury per 1,000 PICU patient days did not change. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug dispenses per 1,000 patient days were reduced from 521 to 456. Similarly, opioid and benzodiazepine exposures per 1,000 patient days were reduced from 812 to 524 and 441 to 227, respectively, during the study observation period. Conclusions: the NINJA intervention was efficaciously implemented in our single-center PICU. Nephrotoxic exposure is a modifiable factor that did not inadvertently increase exposure to opioids and benzodiazepines. The fourth online clinical investigation article is entitled Pediatric Reference Change Value Optimized for Acute Kidney Injury, Multicenter Retrospective Study in China, by Jingxia Zhang et al. Objectives: the standard definition of pediatric acute kidney injury is evolving, especially for critically ill patients in the PICU. We sought to validate the application of the Pediatric Reference Change Value Optimized for Acute Kidney Injury in Children, or PROC, criteria in critically ill children. Design: multicenter retrospective study. Setting: 6 PICUs in mainland China. Patients: 1,678 hospitalized children admitted to the PICU with at least 2 creatinine values within 7 days. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: acute kidney injury was diagnosed and staged according to the pediatric risk, injury, failure, loss, end-stage renal disease, or PRIFL criteria, the kidney disease improving global outcomes or KDIGO criteria, and the PROC criteria. Multiple clinical parameters were assessed and analyzed along with 90-day follow-up outcomes. According to the definitions of PRIFL, KDIGO, and PROC, the prevalence of acute kidney injury in our cohort of 1,678 cases was 52.8% or 886, 39% or 655, and 19% or 318, respectively. The presence of acute kidney injury as defined by PROC was associated with increased number of injured organs, occurrence of sepsis, use of mechanical ventilation, and use of continuous renal replacement therapy with a p-value less than 0.05, as well as higher pediatric risk of mortality 3 score and higher pediatric logistic organ dysfunction 2 score with a p-value less than 0.001. The survival curve of 90-day outcomes showed that PROC was associated with shorter survival time with a p-value less than 0.001, and PROC definition was associated with better separation of the different stages of acute kidney injury from non-acute kidney injury with a p-value less than 0.001. Conclusions: in this retrospective analysis of acute kidney injury criteria in PICU admissions in China, PROC is better correlated with severity and outcomes of acute kidney injury. Hence, the PROC criteria for acute kidney injury may have better utility in critically ill children. The online cardiac intensive care article is entitled Routine Perioperative Esmolol After Infant Tetralogy of Fallot Repair, Single Center Retrospective Study of Hemodynamics, by Jeremy Affelter et al. Objectives: currently, surgical repair of tetralogy of Fallot is associated with a 1.1% 30-day mortality rate. Those with junctional ectopic tachycardia, or JET, and restrictive right ventricular physiology have poorer outcomes. Routine postoperative adrenergic or inodilator therapy has been reported, while beta blockade following cardiopulmonary bypass has not. This study evaluated routine perioperative treatment with esmolol in infants undergoing tetralogy of Fallot repair. Design: retrospective chart review of the perioperative course following tetralogy of Fallot repair. Setting: single-center case series describing perioperative management of tetralogy of Fallot in a cardiac ICU. Patients: this study reviewed all patients less than 18 months old who underwent tetralogy of Fallot repair, excluding cases of tetralogy of Fallot with absent pulmonary valve or atrioventricular septal defect at our institution from June 2018 to April 2021. Interventions: This review investigates the hemodynamic effects of esmolol following cardiopulmonary bypass for tetralogy of Fallot repair. Measurements and main results. Preoperative clinical characteristics and perioperative course were extracted from the medical record. Descriptive statistics were used. 26 patients receiving perioperative esmolol after tetralogy of Fallot repair were identified and included. Postoperative hemodynamic parameters were within a narrow range with minimal vasoactive support in most patients. 3 of 26 patients experienced JET, and 1 of 26 of whom had a brief cardiac arrest. Median and interquartile range for hospital and postoperative length of stay was 7 days, with an interquartile range of 6 to 9 days, and 6 days with an interquartile range of 5 to 8 days, respectively. There were no 30-day or 1-year mortalities. Conclusions. In this infant cohort, our experience is that the routine use of postoperative esmolol is associated with good cardiac output with minimal requirement for vasoactive support in most patients. We believe optimal postoperative management of infant tetralogy of Fallot repair requires a meticulous multidisciplinary approach, which in our experience is enhanced with routine postoperative esmolol treatment. The first online brief report is entitled Proton Pump Inhibitor Use and Associated Infectious Complications in the PICU, Propensity Score Matching Analysis by Isabel Goyer et al. Objectives. We aimed to evaluate the association between proton pump inhibitor or PPI exposure and nosocomial infections during PICU stay. Design. Propensity score matched analysis of a single center retrospective cohort from January 1, 2017 to December 31, 2018. Setting. Tertiary medical and surgical PICU in France. Patients. Patients younger than 18 years old admitted to the PICU with a stay greater than 48 hours. Intervention. Patients were retrospectively allocated into two groups and compared depending on whether they received a PPI or not. Measurements and main results. 754 patients were included, of which 231 or 31% received a PPI. PPIs were used for stress ulcer prophylaxis in 174 of 231 or 75%, but upper gastrointestinal bleed risk factors were rarely present, only 18%. In the unadjusted analyses, the rate of nosocomial infection was 8% in the PPI-exposed group versus 2% in the non-exposed group. After propensity score matching, N equals 184 per group, we failed to identify an association between PPI exposure and greater odds of nosocomial infection, with an adjusted odds ratio of 2.9 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.9 to 9.3 with a p-value equal to 0.082. However, these data have not excluded the possibility that there is up to a 9-fold greater odds of nosocomial infection. Conclusions. This study highlights the prevalent use of PPIs in the PICU and the potential association between PPIs and 9-fold greater odds of nosocomial infections is not excluded. The second online brief report is entitled Outcomes of Critically Ill Children with Acute Lymphoblastic Leukemia and Cytokine Release Syndrome Due to Chimeric Antigen Receptor T-Cell Therapy, U.S. Multicenter PICU Cohort Database Study by Grace Logan et al. Objectives. Cytokine release syndrome, or CRS, is a potentially lethal toxicity associated with chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy for pediatric acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL. Outcomes after critical illness due to severe CRS are poorly described. Our aim was to characterize critical illness outcomes across a multicenter cohort of PICU patients with ALL and CRS. Design, multicenter retrospective cohort study. Setting. 21 PICUs contributing data to virtual pediatric systems from January 2020 to December 2021. Patients. PICU patients with ALL or unclassified leukemia and CRS. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We identified 55 patients. 34 or 62% were 12 years or older, 48 or 87% were admitted from a hospital inpatient ward, and 23 or 42% received advanced organ failure support or monitoring. 51 survived to PICU discharge, or 93%, including 19 of 23 or 83% who received advanced organ failure support or monitoring defined as receipt of non-invasive or invasive ventilation, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, continuous renal replacement therapy, or placement of a tracheostomy, arterial catheter, hemodialysis catheter, or intracranial catheter. 12 patients, or 22%, received invasive ventilation, 9 of whom survived to PICU discharge. 2 of 4 patients who received continuous renal replacement therapy and 1 of 3 patients who required cardiopulmonary resuscitation survived to PICU discharge. Lengths of PICU stay were median 3 days with an interquartile range of 1.4 to 7.8 days among PICU survivors, 7.8 with an interquartile range of 5.4 to 11.1 among those receiving advanced organ failure support or monitoring, and 7.2 days with an interquartile range of 2.9 to 14.7 days among non-survivors. Of the 51 patients who survived to PICU discharge, 48 or 94% survived the hospitalization. Conclusions. PICU patients with CRS frequently received a high level of support, and the majority survived their PICU stay and hospitalization. Additional multicenter investigations of severe CRS are necessary to inform evidence-based practice. The final online brief report is entitled Bereaved Caregiver Perspectives on the End of Life in Pediatric Patients with Ventricular Assist Devices by Christine Boy et al. Objectives. Ventricular assist devices, or VADs, are increasingly used in pediatric heart failure as bridges to heart transplantation, although 25% will die with VADs. Family experiences in this population are not well described. The objective is to understand bereaved families' perspectives on VAD and end-of-life decision-making. Design: semi-structured interviews with bereaved caregivers of pediatric VAD patients. Setting: tertiary children's hospital. Patients: families of 6 pediatric VAD patients who died from 2014 to 2020. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Applying a grounded theory framework, interviews were coded by 2 independent readers using qualitative software. Themes were discussed in iterative multidisciplinary meetings. Participants were interviewed at a median 2.4 years after their child died. 3 major themes emerged. 1. Lack of regret for VAD implantation despite the outcome. 2. Caregiver-child accord at implantation and end of life was important in family decision-making via patient's verbal assent or physical cues. And 3. Development of a local surrogate family, including the medical team and peer families, provided powerful support. Conclusions. Bereaved families' perspectives provide insight into quality decision-making for major interventions and end-of-life care in pediatric patients with chronic illness who face decisions regarding technology dependence. This month's narrative is entitled Can You Hold Him? By Jamie Lump. If I close my eyes, I can hear the soundtrack of the PICU. The constant monitor alarms and subsequent silencing, the clanging of the tube system as it delivers another medication from pharmacy, the ringing phones and pagers, and the chatter of staff. I have had this soundtrack memorized since fellowship. But as I stood outside of a more private corner room in the ICU, 32 weeks pregnant, my mind was utterly silent. I was moments away from guiding 2 extremely loving parents through the most peaceful death possible for their 6-month-old baby boy. You could say I am trained for this. I am one of a growing number of dual-trained pediatric intensive care and pediatric palliative care physicians. Although heralded as important work, pediatric illness and death are not easy dinner party conversation. Admittedly, when I am asked what I do for a living, I almost always omit the entire truth. I am a pediatrician, I say. I find that it is easier to stomach the ensuing smile than to defend the beauty of my work in fields of medicine otherwise popularly classified as sad. I walked into that intensive care room. The curtains were drawn, and the quiet was deafening. The parents and I had spoken about everything. We extubated and reintubated, repeated all the blood testing and the MRI, and the treatment we feared would have little or no efficacy. We expedited the genetic testing, and then we waited together. Because as the COVID-19 pandemic droned on, hospital policy precluded any more than 2 visitors at the bedside. In the weeks of waiting, we told jokes. We discussed what we ordered for dinner delivery, and we shared small bits of who we were outside of our clinical relationship. "Do you mind me asking what you are having?" the mother asked. "A baby boy," I answered. "It must be hard to be pregnant and care for us," the father said. "It's my job," I replied. It was suspected that a rapidly progressive metabolic disorder had transformed this happy, smiling baby boy to an unrecognizable version of himself. The true art of medicine is considering both your gut instinct and the medical data. My inner voice was repeatedly telling me that he had a terminal prognosis. Time stands still while waiting, and I have noticed that, during this time, parents try to find comfort in the small things. A long shower and a change of clothes, a walk outside, or coffee that comes from somewhere other than a hospital meal tray. Perhaps there is a small sense of relief that there can be no bad news, not this weekend anyway. On a slow and sunny Saturday afternoon, I received a call from the geneticist confirming our worst fears. In the pandemic era, we are forced to give life-changing news via phone and Zoom with our facial expressions and body language blunted by personal protective equipment. With those barriers to nonverbal communication, it is harder to feel the natural connections our compassions should engender. So many small pieces were missing. Subspecialists were not present at the bedside, and family meetings necessitated an email link and passcode. Nevertheless, the results that needed to be shared that day were abysmal. A rare and rapidly progressive autosomal recessive disorder was ravaging their son's body, and if that news was not bad enough, both parents were carriers of this mutation, giving their future children a 25% chance of also having the same disease. I speedily walked to the patient's room after speaking with the geneticist, who shared that he is planning to call and talk with the parents about the diagnosis in a few minutes. "They can't hear this information over the phone," I thought. They took one look at me, and they knew their worst fears had come to fruition. In our discussions, we had dug deep into their anticipatory grief. We talked about what his death would look like, and we had planned his funeral. We had also talked about life prolongation. This disease had no treatment. He would be dependent on a tracheostomy, a ventilator, a G-tube, and a multitude of medications. There were so many tears as they grabbed my hand. That's not a life we want for him. We all knew what the next steps would be. In my junior career, I have advised and been witness to a lot of death. I have held emotion with hugs, tears, and condolences. What was asked of me next after we decided to pursue discontinuation of life-sustaining technology was a career first, a true honor, but also an incredible burden to bear. "Would you be willing to hold him until he dies?" the father asked. His parents had decided they wanted to read him a bedtime story, and they wanted to look at him one last time, but it felt like too much to hold him while he died. They wanted their last memories to be of the smiley, happy baby whose picture was ever present on the lock screen of their cell phones. He was a hero to them, one who would hopefully be paving the way for the birth of his healthy siblings with the use of genetic testing and reproductive technology. In the days that preceded his death, I processed while they prepared. I was nervous as I held their dying baby boy across my lap, while my unborn child kicked incessantly. We listened to music, and I reminded him how much his parents loved him and how brave he had been during his very short time on this earth. Time of death, 5:26 p.m. I still think of these parents and that moment. They remind me to be present and humble for my patients and families. I think of them, tears streaming down my face as I watch my 8-week-old son sleep on my chest. The juxtaposition of life and death. This concludes the abstracts for the December issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.